Imagine walking into a rotting subterranean cave. The air is so thick with decay, you can practically taste it.
Ugh, yeah, absolutely foul.
Right, and the floor is piled deep with these splintered white bones of wolves and, like, giant horses. You are hunting a massive, flesh-eating shadow beast. You creep past all this ruined debris, weapon drawn, adrenaline just spiking.
Oh, totally. You're ready for a fight.
Exactly. So you pry open this heavy wooden door at the very back of the cavern, and you find yourself standing in a perfectly clean, dust-free guest room.
It's so jarring.
There's a plush rug, a cozy bed, a warm ceramic stove, and like a polished writing desk with a wax seal just resting on top of it.
It is the ultimate subversion of expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, you brace yourself for a monster, and instead, you find the unmistakable footprint of a political conspiracy.
Exactly. So welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring a truly fascinating collection of source material today. It's a series of text-based role-playing logs from, I think, the year 2008.
Yeah, 2008, set in the fantasy realm of Mirari.
Right, Mirari. And our mission today is not just to recap some old fantasy story. We are going to unpack how a simple monster hunt transforms into an absolute masterclass in character dynamics, environmental storytelling, and honestly, psychological warfare.
It really is a masterclass, because what this narrative does so brilliantly is contrast the physical masks people wear to protect themselves with the psychological truths they are ultimately forced to confront later on.
Yeah. Let's set the scene for everyone. We join our two main characters resting at an inn in the town of Lunafell. It's the morning after a major celebration, and they are an incredibly mismatched pair.
To put it mildly.
Right. So on one side, we have Redmayne. She is a knight, but she's also half Jotun. And for those not deep into the lore, Jotun basically means giant kin.
Giant kin, yeah.
So she is physically massive, deeply grounded, burdened by a very dark past, and bound by Aegeus to the goddess Ceridwen.
And we should probably clarify what Aegeus actually is, because it's not just, you know, a regular promise.
Oh, good point.
Aegeus is a magically binding vow. It's woven directly into your soul. If you break it, the consequences are physically and spiritually catastrophic.
It's a huge deal.
Exactly. So when Redmayne says she is bound to this goddess, she is carrying a literal magical anchor that dictates her every single move.
Right. And then, on the exact opposite side of the room, we have Thomas. He's a fae. Very agile, ethereal, and utterly terrified of iron.
Very important detail.
Yeah, very. He claims to be nothing more than an unaligned tracker who's just passing through. But the guy is obviously harboring an absolute mountain of secrets.
Oh, yeah. We see that stark contrast between them the literal moment they wake up. The morning banter sets the stage perfectly.
It really does.
They've been sharing a room purely platonically, and while Redmayne wakes up stretching, taking her time, being very pragmatic about the morning routine.
Thomas literally rolls out of the bed.
Yes. He lands on all fours, executes a forward somersault, pops up onto his feet holding his pants, and does a high stepping spin just to put them on in midair.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because that level of performance is highly suspicious. I really don't think Thomas is just being a carefree, whimsical fae creature putting on a show for the fun of it.
No, definitely not.
That literal physical acrobatics flipping into his pants, refusing to just stand still, it perfectly mirrors his conversational acrobatics. Every single time Redmayne tries to ask a genuine question about his past or his motivations, what does he do? He deflects with a joke.
Every time.
He's using humor as a highly evolved defense mechanism, isn't he?
What's fascinating here is how his physical movement reflects a deep-seated need to avoid being pinned down. Like, he is a fae, so his entire nature is tied to lightness and motion.
Right.
But emotionally, you are spot on. He uses this constant barrage of jokes and physical comedy to build an impenetrable wall. He keeps Redmayne at arm's length because vulnerability is terrifying to him.
And Redmayne is just the total opposite. She is anchored to a heavy, ironclad reality. I mean, over breakfast, she just casually drops a massive emotional bombshell.
At the breakfast scene.
Yeah. She plainly admits to Thomas that she has no friends from her past life. She literally says the only thing she kept from her past is, quote, the weight of her sins.
That is so heavy.
And she explains that her Aegeus actually prevents her from experiencing any long-lasting happiness until she pays off her massive debt to the goddess.
It is an incredibly heavy admission to make over breakfast. And look at where they are having this conversation, too. They're eating what the innkeeper calls Outback Porridge.
Which sounds and looks like warm, chunky mud.
It really does. And Thomas flat out refuses to touch it. He makes this elaborate joke about how one spoon of the porridge puts you out back in the outhouse for an hour.
Yeah, and two spoons keeps you there until lunch.
Exactly. Think about what is happening mechanically in the dialogue there. Redmayne offers a profound, raw piece of her soul, and Thomas immediately diffuses the tension with a toilet joke.
It's classic avoidance.
Have you ever noticed how, in your own life, the moment a conversation gets uncomfortably real, someone inevitably cracks a joke? Thomas is doing exactly that. He is terrified of her emotional gravity.
The contrast gets even sharper, and frankly, a lot more dangerous, when they head out to the stables. We really have to talk about Redmayne's horse, Rhiannon.
Oh, Rhiannon.
Because calling Rhiannon a horse feels like a massive understatement. She is a draft-sized Fomorian blood mare, and Fomorian implies this dark, monstrous, ancient lineage.
Very dark.
She is consecrated to Epona, the goddess of horses. She absolutely hates men, and she has literal canine teeth.
A horse with the teeth of a predator that instantly tells you everything you need to know about the world Redmayne inhabits.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It is a brutal world that requires brutal tools for survival.
And Thomas is practically vibrating with fear around this animal. Not just because the horse could literally bite his arm off, but because Rhiannon is shod in heavy iron.
Right, the iron.
Thomas is fey. And in this lore, iron is absolute kryptonite to the fey. It's the metal of human industry. It disrupts their natural magic, it grounds them, and it physically burns them.
It's agonizing for them.
And Rhiannon gives Thomas a sniff,
curls
her lips back, and slams a giant iron-shod hoof down just a bare half inch from his big toe.
And Thomas even mentions that his old scars ache just being near it. But notice Redmayne's reaction.
She just laughs.
Yeah, she laughs and says, I think she likes you. Then she sheathes her lance so the point extends past the horse's chest.
Basically turning her horse into a battering ram.
Precisely. She essentially turns her mount into a weapon. It firmly establishes Redmayne as the protector figure. She is armored, she is massive, and she operates as a human tank.
So this tank and this acrobat finally leave the safety of the town. They head out into the deep snow to track the beast they've been hired to kill. And this is where Thomas proves he's not just a clown.
Not at all.
His tracking skills are phenomenal. He isn't just looking for generic footprints in the snow. He explains how he reads the wind-blowing snow back into old prints to gauge time.
It's so detailed.
He analyzes the pressure ridges left by a heel-to-toe roll to determine the exact direction and weight distribution of the stride.
It's basically forensic science applied to a fantasy setting. It shows us that beneath the jokes and the tumbling, Thomas is hyper-competent and fiercely intelligent.
Definitely.
And they need every ounce of that intelligence when they actually locate the creature's lair.
Right. So the lair is this decaying cave system connected to an underground river. And the environment is highly unsettling. The cave actually feels like it's breathing.
Which is such a creepy detail.
Because the flow of the underground river creates a vacuum that pulls air through the tight stone passages in this rhythmic rhythm.
It creates a complete sensory nightmare. The air smells of old blood and rot. And the floor is covered literally feet deep in ghastly white bones.
We were talking fey bones, wolf bones, and the massive bones of giant horses.
It is the textbook definition of a monster's lair. So they check a couple of side doors built into the cavern, and they just find ruined, rotting wooden furniture.
So far, everything is tracking with their expectations. But then they open the third door, and they walk into that pristine, dust-free guest room we talked about at the top of the show.
It's so weird.
The rug, the bed,
right.
The ceramic stove with silver piping.
The environment completely subverts the narrative.
Wait, hold on. I need to stop you there because this is the part that melts my brain. A cozy guest room? Inside the lair of a horse-eating monster?
I know.
That makes absolutely zero logistical sense. Why wouldn't a master forger or a political operative just rent a secure, secret basement in the city? Why risk setting up an office where your guard dog might decide to eat you?
This raises an important question, and it gets to the brilliance of the villain's strategy. Think about how a biological padlock works. If you rent a basement in the city, you have to deal with nosy neighbors, city guards, a paper trail. But if you domesticate, or at least control, a shadow beast, you create a natural perimeter of death that no one in their right mind will ever cross.
Oh, wow.
The beast is a pawn. It keeps the authorities away because everyone assumes the missing people are just victims of a wild animal. The monster provides the perfect cover for a highly sophisticated, politically motivated operation.
That makes a terrifying amount of sense. And Thomas immediately goes into detective mode. He inspects the writing desk. There's no liquid ink, presumably because it would freeze in a cave, but he finds bitter ink powder and wax sticks.
And then he finds it.
The smoking gun.
Right.
A wooden box filled with authentic house seals. These are quartz posts with animal carvings, including the official seal for House May.
Which is incredibly significant, lore-wise. The ruling class of Merari is structured around these calendar-themed noble houses, like House May and Lord December.
Right.
Possessing an authentic house seal means you have the power to issue official edicts, move armies, collect taxes. It's massive power.
But the best part of the scene is what Thomas does with the blank parchment he finds on the desk. He uses this brilliant coal dust trick.
Oh, I love this part.
He takes pieces of unused coal from the stove, crushes them with the butt of his dagger into a fine powder, and then sprinkles that powder over the blank stack of paper. He gently shakes the paper side to side.
It's basic, brilliant forensics. When someone presses a heavy wax seal onto a document, the pressure creates microscopic indentations on the blank pages resting underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
The fine coal dust catches in those invisible grooves, revealing the ghost of whatever was written previously.
Yes. The dust settles and reveals a faint script and a large, complex forged seal. It's 12 circles in a spiral, falling away from a central shape that looks like a castle.
So Thomas realizes they have stumbled into a massive forgery ring. Someone is forging letters from the ruling lords, sending them via crow, and using the beast to keep the world away.
They also find a metal Jack of Hearts pendant hidden under the bed, which screams that whoever is running this is playing a very intentional, highly theatrical game.
But here's where they make a critical, almost fatal error. Because they are exhausted from the hunt, they decide to lock the door and actually sleep in the comfortable bed inside the monster's lair.
I mean, on one hand, I get it. It's a nice bed. On the other hand, it is a spectacular failure of risk assessment because by sleeping in that room, they trigger the trap.
Exactly. They solve the physical mystery of the room, but by staying, they invite a deeply personal psychological attack.
Redmayne wakes up later that night. The ceramic stove is burned down to embers, and Thomas is gone. She wanders into the dark hallway, forces open a jammed door, slips on a rug, and finds herself staring at an ornate, perfectly pristine mirror that takes up the entire back wall of the chamber.
Notice the environmental storytelling again. The rotting, breathing cave outside, and this impossibly clean, untouched, magical mirror hidden inside.
It's so eerie. Redmayne draws her silver sword, thinking the mirror might be a doorway or a portal. But her reflection reaches out, physically grabs the blade of the sword, and holds it with incredible strength.
Unbelievable.
Then the reflection steps out of the mirror. It becomes a shadow clone. And it speaks to Redmayne in her own voice, telling her to put away her legacy and embrace what she truly is, a monster.
This is where the psychological warfare really begins. The clone doesn't attack her physically, it attacks her deepest insecurities.
Right.
It targets her Jotun blood. It tells her that because she is half giant, she is inherently monstrous, that she will never be a hero to the Fae, and that they will never accept her.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This magic mirror operates exactly like a highly personalized algorithm or like an internet troll.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
It doesn't throw a fireball at you. It specifically mines your internal search history. It bypasses your armor, finds your deepest imposter syndrome, and weaponizes it against you.
Yes, exactly.
For Redmayne, her biggest fear is that her rigid knightly code is a lie, and that beneath it, she is just the violent giant everyone assumes she is.
That is a perfect analogy. The mirror isolates her. The clone then shifts its form to look like Thomas, but cleaner, less weathered. It projects a vision behind him, a burning village under a blood-red sky, and Thomas standing over the dead body of a young black-haired woman holding a bloody silver sword.
It is literally showing her a deepfake to prove that Thomas is a killer and will betray her. The clone offers her acceptance if she just gives up and embraces the darkness.
But she doesn't.
No, Redmayne refuses. She tells the reflection that she lived for centuries as a monster and wasn't happy, and she'd rather seek atonement.
The clone gets furious, turns into an emaciated shadow, throws the silver sword back at her head, and vanishes.
It's a powerful moment of resilience, but the trap isn't done. Thomas finally returns. He had just been out catching a rabbit for stew, and when he sees the mirror, he touches the glass.
And this is where things go terribly, terribly wrong for him.
Yeah.
Right. Thomas identifies the mirror as a displaced glamour of old Fey origin. Now, let's explain the mechanics of that because it's important.
Please do.
A standard glamour is an illusion. It hides something ugly to make it look beautiful. A displaced glamour reverses that process. It acts as a psychic snare.
Oh, I see.
When Thomas touches it, it reads his magical signature, latches onto his pulse, and pulls his ugliest, most buried fears out of his mind, projecting them into reality. It displaces his physical surroundings with his own nightmare.
So his hand gets physically trapped against the glass. The mirror hums, his entire life flashes by in a blur, and it freezes on a vision tailored specifically to destroy his ego.
It's so specific, too.
He sees himself dressed in formal lord's garb, wearing a green velvet beret with a hawk pin, standing in the central court of Merari. And all the nobles around him, the ruling class, are pointing at him, laughing and looking at him with absolute pity.
Look at the contrast between their fears. Redmayne's fear was entirely internal, the fear of her own nature, her own blood.
Yeah.
Thomas's fear is entirely social and systemic. He isn't afraid of monsters. He is terrified of public humiliation, of being rejected and pitied by the ruling class.
Thomas's face in the vision twists into pure anger, and the mirror violently shatters into thousands of pieces.
The enemy's true power here wasn't a physical beast. The magic was designed to break the fragile trust forming between these two outsiders.
Right, because if they fight each other, they don't fight the conspiracy.
Exactly. The forgers knew that anyone capable of finding the lair would be dangerous, so they left a psychological landmine to turn intruders against themselves or against each other before they could expose the political conspiracy.
And surviving that psychological landmine forces all of their underlying philosophical differences right up to the surface. Cut to a little while later, they are sitting around eating this weak rabbit stew Thomas made, and they have to decide what to do with this massive political secret.
And they do not agree.
Not at all. Redmayne is absolutely adamant. She says it is her duty as a knight of the realm to report this dark magic and the forgery ring to the royal court.
But Thomas is deeply cynical. He warns her that the nobles are not trustworthy. If she walks into the court and says she was attacked by dark fey magic, they won't help her.
No, they won't.
They will quarantine her. They will examine her. He practically begs her to learn the art of selective reporting for her own survival.
And then, true to form, to break the incredibly heavy tension, Thomas makes a crude joke. He tells her the story of Sir Griswold, the great dragon lair.
Oh my goodness.
Who, because he was hard of hearing, seduced a dragon instead of slaying it.
It's his classic conversational acrobatics again. But it also highlights his complete lack of reverence for the institution of knighthood that Redmayne holds so dear.
So what does this all mean? I really want to push back on Thomas's cynicism here. He acts like he's the smartest guy in the room because he doesn't trust the system. But isn't Redmayne's rigid black and white moral code the literal only thing keeping her from becoming the monster the mirror claims she is?
That's a very fair point.
If she drops her chivalry and starts operating in the gray areas, lying to the court like Thomas wants, doesn't she lose the one anchor she has left?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that tension is the crux of their entire dynamic. You have two fundamentally different survival strategies for trauma.
Okay, lay them out.
Redmayne seeks systemic redemption. She wants to atone to her goddess. She wants to report to the proper authorities. She needs the structure of the system to validate her goodness because she doesn't trust herself.
And Thomas trusts only himself.
Exactly. Thomas seeks personal survival completely outside the system. He avoids towns. He hides his status as a lord, which the mirror clearly revealed he is. And he inherently believes that institutions only exist to crush individuals.
And yet, they are stuck with each other. Their path forward requires them to travel toward the territory of House November. But Thomas explicitly admits he's banned from their towns.
Yep, he can't go there.
He cannot be seen by the authorities. So he has to make a choice. And very hesitantly, he offers to bypass the towns entirely and take Redmayne to his actual personal home on the border.
Which is a monumental concession for someone whose entire personality is built around deflection and secrecy.
It really is.
Inviting this knight into his private sanctuary shows a profound, reluctant trust. The psychological attack from the mirror was designed to tear them apart. but it actually forced them to rely on each other in a way they never would have otherwise.
It is incredible. I mean, think about the journey we just went on. It started with two unlikely companions trading jokes over terrible mud porridge and dodging a giant man-hating horse.
And it evolved, step by logical step, into uncovering a shadowy political forgery operation.
Right, finding a pristine room inside a rotting cave. And culminating in a devastating psychological test by a magic mirror that mined their deepest traumas.
It brilliantly highlights how heavily people carry their pasts. Redmayne carries the literal weight of her giant blood and her heavy iron weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas carries the invisible, crushing sting of a laughing court and the necessity of hiding his true identity behind acrobatics and jokes.
And it shows how shared trauma is a crucible. It will either completely shatter a relationship or it will forge it into something much, much deeper. Hmm. They survived the wilderness of each other's minds, at least for today.
They did. But the conspiracy of the forged house seals is still out there, and now they are deeply entangled in it.
Which brings us to the end of today's deep dive. We've talked a lot about masks, deflections, and the things we hide from the people around us.
We sure have.
So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today. Imagine you are traveling or working with someone you are just starting to trust.
Okay.
If a magic mirror perfectly exposed your absolute deepest, darkest insecurity to that brand new friend today, would your bond survive the revelation? Or would the truth shatter the relationship entirely?
That's a heavy question. True vulnerability always is.
It really is. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Until next time, watch your step in the dark.